Welcome to The Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature.
It sunbathes because it doesn't have to eat anymore, because it's photosynthetic. It's as if your houseplants produced food directly available to you, so you put your houseplants in your body and permanently let them take up residence there. It's that kind of comparison. It's not just giant clams, and it's not just worms. It's many, many animals.
It's all alive. It's all connected. It's all intelligent. It's all relatives.
Scientists tell us that concern with the environment will no longer be one of many single issues in the next century. It will move to the center of the stage. It will become the context of everything, of our lives, our businesses, our politics. We are, in fact, moving from the information age to the age of biology. In this series, The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature, we salute the pioneers, the biological pioneers who are working with nature to heal nature, reducing the human footprint, honoring native wisdom, and restoring the earth by changing the world. A sage once noted, "If you're bored, then you're not paying attention." Just contemplating the biochemical cascade of events that occur with each breath you take is enough to blow your mind. Then consider where the impulse to draw that breath came from. There's another lifetime of adventure. Then exhale. Looking closely into the life of the living could be called the way of biology. Since before recorded human history, we have studied the ways of plants, animals, and fungi, leading us to startling revelations about what it is to be Homo sapiens on this planet. In this program, biologist Lynn Margulis, ethnobotanist Wade Davis, and mycologist Paul Stamets, three bio-exuberant explorers, return briefly from the fields of wonder to tell tales of amazing biointelligence, like the hunting hat-thrower mushroom and animals that eat light. Join us for the next half hour as we explore the wonders of Gaia, the symbiotic planet. My name is Michael Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to The Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature. Lynn Margulis, currently at the Department of Geosciences at the University of Massachusetts, is a world-renowned biologist and science educator. A member of the prestigious U.S. National Academy of Sciences, whose work spans a wide range of areas, including cell biology and microbial evolution, she is best known as the co-creator, with James Lovelock, of the Gaia Hypothesis. Margulis is exploring the big questions. Book titles she has co-authored with her son, Dorian Sagan, include What is Life? Microcosmos, 4 billion Years of Evolution from Our Microbial Ancestors. What is Sex? And Acquiring Genomes, a Theory of the Origin of Species. She spoke with producer Neil Harvey about some remarkable life forms she is studying that appear to be animals, but like plants, they eat light.
What's a plant? What's an animal? If you go to the beaches at Brittany and the Channel Islands and near Spain, you see the seaweed. It looks like seaweed. And if you do a big scientific experiment, it's green, it incorporates carbon dioxide from the air to make food in the presence of light only, and gives off oxygen. Now that's a very plant-like behavior. And if you get very close to it, you'll see that it has a mouth, muscles, eyes, it squiggles through the sand. It is unambiguously a worm. It's a worm that doesn't feed with that mouth. It only uses that mouth to puncture seaweed and steal its little photosynthetic factories inside, these little chloroplasts. So if we're going to define a plant as an organism that has these photosynthetic green chloroplasts in its cells, then that organism has to be a plant. But if we look at it and it lays eggs and it mates and the eggs are white and they hatch out of, they break open through a little eggshell, and then these algae are attracted to it, and it eats them, and it eats lots of things. It digests everything except the algae it wants to put into its body, and then it harbors them in the body, and it sunbathes for the rest of its life.
It sunbathes
because it doesn't have to eat anymore, because it's photosynthetic, because it's acting like a plant, but it isn't a plant, it's an animal. This kind of phenomenon, we understand, is an evolutionary phenomenon that happened over and over again in the history of life. Why? Because if you're translucent and you're in the water and you're starving and you tend to eat green things, the light still gets through your body and the green things still photosynthesize. So you digest them more slowly and take advantage of them that way. So we have slugs, snails, shellless snails that have done that. We have different kinds of shellless snails. We have many kinds of flatworms that have done that. By done that, I mean they are green animals. They are bona fide green animals. And we think, well, that's okay for the lower animals. I hate the word lower, by the way. Darwin said never use lower. And I've decided that higher animals means closer to your relatives. In other words, the highest ones are your own relatives.
Whoever's
right?
talking about animals that's, is closest to us.
That's right. That's right. So these words higher and lower mean nothing because all organisms alive today are equally as evolved. I mean, they wouldn't be alive today. They have the same kinds of 4-billion-year-old evolutionary history. But anyway, I do want to say that there's a little... an animal called a didymnid. It belongs to our phylum. Well, what phylum is a big group of animals. I mean, we are, of course, Homo sapiens. That's our genus and species. And we're in the primates. That's our order. And we're in family, maybe Hominidae. And then we're mammals. That's our class. And our class is one of the phylum. And our phylum is chordates, chordata. That means our backbones and other things. In that same phylum, there are organisms that people call sea squirts because they look like lemons on the beach and you step on them and they squirt. Their larva form is very much like a little fish. I mean, they're related to us. And those organisms, too, have members that have eaten and not digested photosynthetic symbionts, and they live in Palau and other tropical places on mangrove roots in the shallow seas. They're completely green, and if you go up close to them, they turn out to be like little tadpoles that are completely green. So over and over again was starvation. Over and over again were translucent bodies. Over and over again were hungry animals that just failed to digest actively, and all photosynthetic organisms leak. So why do a garden if you can put the thing in your body and put the green organism to work for you in your body? So this is just one of the fascinating stories. And it's not just once, it's many times.
Brilliant.
The giant clams, for example. We go to Chinese restaurants occasionally, we shouldn't, but we see these huge giant clams as decorations on the wall or as drinking fountains. You probably know what I mean. That organism is called Tridacna. You see it in the movies as attacking swimmers or divers. That is the biggest nonsense in the world. Those organisms have their shells, the clam shells, open permanently so that the mantle cavity, this tissue of the animal, is actually focusing the light on its photosynthetic symbionts. If it didn't do that, that animal would die by starvation. I mean, very, very quickly. So if you put this clam in the dark, its algae will leave, and it'll die, I don't know how long, maybe a couple of days, because it's dying of starvation. Why? Not because it's not fed, but because it doesn't have the light to photosynthesize on its symbiotic algae. Coral reefs.
So they're not just filter feeding.
Not at all. Nothing is filter feeding, as it turns out. Nothing. Filter feeding is our word for when a lot of water passes by and food is taken out of the water. But if you get close to that process ever, it's true that a lot of water is passing through, and it's true that food is being taken out of the water, but it's not filtering. You get to the cell level,
yes,
and those cells are actively picking up the particles of food. And it's not even doing that, no.
They're not just catching, they're grabbing. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying that those symbionts are growing and living and dividing permanently inside the clam, and they're near the window side of the clam tissue, and the window side of the clam tissue has modified to focus the light that is shining the light on the symbionts, just like you shine the light on your houseplants. It's exactly like you shining your light on the houseplants. It's as if your houseplants produced food directly available to you, so you put your houseplants in your body and permanently let them take up residence there. It's that kind of comparison. And that, so it's not just giant clams and it's not just worms, it's many, many animals. And always one understands what the so-called selection pressures are. Why did that happen? Because the choice was die or live off the exudate that falls out of the photosynthetic stuff that's half digested in your body. And it just happened over and over again. Die of starvation or capture these forms, these green organisms.
Lynn Margulis, the co-author of Acquiring Genomes, A Theory of the Origin of Species. She calls the Earth the symbiotic planet. The sea clams and algae seem to be getting along well together, but it turns out that symbiotic alliances are not always inherently beneficial. For example, the partnership people made long ago with annual grasses and cattle was originally a mutually beneficial arrangement. Grasses flourished, cattle flourished, and people flourished. But it wound up sweeping the planet to the exclusion of wider, more diverse food webs like woodlands and wetlands. The key to positive long-term symbiotic success is diversity, life's living repertoire of adaptive possibilities. The problem today is the gene pool of diversity is evaporating to a gene puddle, radically limiting our options just at the time, pioneers warn, we're going to have to adapt to dramatically heightened change. The gene pool is shrinking in the forests of the Pacific Northwest. Paul Stamets is working to save what could be the oldest fleshy organism living on the planet from the brink of extinction.
There is a mushroom that is extraordinarily unique that grows only in the old growth forest. It first came to my attention about 5 or 6 years ago. There were 6 sites of this mushroom. Now we're down to 4 sites.
Paul Stamets, president of Fungi Perfecti, has pioneered countless techniques in the field of edible and medicinal mushroom cultivation and in fungal bioremediation. His books include Growing Gourmet and Medicinal Mushrooms and The Mushroom Cultivator.
Now let me tell you about this mushroom. This mushroom, one of the names for it is Oxyporus nobilissimus. I just love the way that sounds. And it's called the noble polypore. The noble polypore grows on the noble fir. The noble fir is Abies concolor. Now, so the noble polypore mushroom grows on the noble fir tree, which grows in the old growth. They can be up to, I think, 1,200 years of age, usually around 1,800 years of age. In 1947, a really well-known mycologist, kind of the father of American mycology, Dr. Alexander Smith, first reported it. But he wrote down in his notes the wrong forest road number. And so botanists and mycologists write down their field notebooks, you know, where they collect things, how many miles up this road, et cetera. But, you know, going back to camp, it's a very common practice. What road was that? I don't remember. I've been to 10 places that day. And so he wrote down the wrong road. So we couldn't find the location for a long time. And then an amateur mycologist about 15 years ago, I think, discovered his original location and was able to alert another professional mycologist. Oh, I think I found what Alex Smith was talking about. And so Oxyporus nobilissimus, maybe, I would like to say it is, but I don't know for sure, maybe the oldest living fleshy organism on the planet. There is one specimen 6 feet in diameter that was on one of the trails adjacent to the Pacific Crest Trail. Hundreds of hikers were walking over it every year. And a friend of mine who is a mycologist at the University of Washington asked that the trail be diverted because they're walking over an endangered species. This mushroom is totally unique in that it's a soft polypore mushroom. Now, polypore mushrooms are oftentimes the wood conchs. They're really hard. You see them on birch trees and fir trees. You know, they're artist conchs. This one's a soft one. You can bend it with your hands. You can cut it with a knife. You know, you could probably saute it, but that would be terrible. And this mushroom doesn't rot. Alexander Smith made notes of his in 1947. I went back to that same specimen a few months ago, and it's now bigger. We know the diameter of what it was back then. We know what the diameter is at now. This one is only about 3 feet in diameter. The University of Washington asked me to go there, the head of the botany department, because they're really afraid that we're going to lose this species and we don't really understand it well enough. So I went up there and I was able, the first person, to get it into culture. So I may have saved an endangered species. I certainly hope so. But more importantly, or very importantly, not more importantly, is that for a mushroom to exist in the rainforest over, you know, decades, if not hundreds of years, to be a soft polypore, to resist rot from bacteria and other competitor fungi, speaks very loudly to me of its potential candidacy as a source for new antibiotics. Now, this tree that it's growing on, it's the tree, one location the tree is living, it must be 800 years old, it's 160 feet tall, it's a huge, huge tree. And there's one specimen growing on it. About 100 feet away is another stump that is an Abies concolor that has now decomposed. So the stump now that is decomposed from the tree, we were estimating, well, how long does that take? Grows on the tree for several hundred years. The tree is several hundred, you know, 160 feet high or 120 feet high. Who knows? I didn't measure it. It was just goes into the distance above me. And for it to, from that time that it was on that tree to its mother colony, we believe, is, you know, 100 feet away and it's on a stump, the degradation time from the time that tree dies to that stump, adding up all the numbers, we think the resident mushroom mite colony is that the mother colony itself is between 1,200 and 1,600 years of age. And the one that's 6 feet in diameter, who knows, probably 500 years old. And it's a soft, fleshy polypore. It's furry. It's got fur on it, like an animal. It's very sensual. I mean, you can touch this thing, and you really have the impression that you're dealing with a very, very ancient life form. Now, it is thought now all gilled mushrooms, you know, mushrooms you buy in the store have gills. All gilled mushrooms, shiitake mushrooms, have all evolved from polypores. The polypores are the ancient ones, the most ancient of ancient fungi.
Mycologist Paul Stamets. When we return, Wade Davis and more from Lynn Margulis. We're exploring the wonders of Gaia, the symbiotic planet. My name is Michael Toms. You're listening to The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature. From Gaia's fields of wonder, biological exuberants like Lynn Margulis and Paul Stamets are reporting that life is dynamic, creative, messy, and hovers on the edge of chaos. The behavior of complex living systems cannot be predicted from the knowledge of the parts. The whole is always greater than the sum of the parts. A flower and a beetle on a lab bench do not add up to what ethnobotanist and explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society, Wade Davis, has found.
As I began to study botany seriously, all these plants had stories, you know, whether it was the pollination and distribution mechanisms. I mean, when I would learn of these things, they were all points of awe. I mean, something as remarkable as the Victoria water lily. Do you know that big plant you'll find in botanical gardens with those enormous leaves? And it's got this flower the size of a cauliflower, you know, enormous blossom. But its pollination mechanism is quite extraordinary. You know, it grows in these oxbow lakes and sloughs on the edges of the Amazon. A child could have a nap on one of its leaves. It's that buoyant. But the most fascinating thing is the blossom comes up from beneath the water at dusk and suddenly opens up its sepals, which are bright white. And the metabolic processes, which have been working away all afternoon, said clouds of perfume over the surface of the swamp. And those same processes have been heating up the carpal to exactly 11 degrees centigrade above whatever the ambient temperature is. The perfume, the scent, and the heat attracts beetles that come in, that get into the nectaries at the base of the carpal, but then as they're munching away, unbeknownst to them, the plant closes, and then it goes, takes them on a little ride down beneath the swamp for 24 hours, and then it comes back up. By this point, it opens up just the sepals and reveals these stunningly magenta petals, which warn any other insect to stay away. And then the beetles themselves, by that point, they've munched away at all the nectaries, and they've brought their pollen to the flower. But it's at that point that the anthers mature, and as they leave in their desperate hunger, because they've been starved inside a prison, they carry the pollen from the anthers to an adjacent flower. And everywhere you look in botany, you find these extraordinary examples. I mean, I know that Paul Stamets would be offended for me to call a mushroom a plant, but he'd be delighted for me to tell this wonderful story of Palobolus. Have you ever heard of the dance group in New York called Palobolus? Do you know where they get their name? Well, you know where they get their name is from the Palobolus hat thrower mushroom. And what this little creature does, it parasitizes flies. And the fly lands as it's dying, always on a vertical surface, and the fruiting body sprouts out of it. And the tip of the fruiting body has a little light-sensitive lens, which is like an anti-aircraft gun, moves around like that, responding to shadows in the light. And as a fly shoots over, the shadow triggers the spore, which shoots up, hits it out of the air, and then it eventually parasitizes the fly, and the whole cycle is completed. I mean, you know, God must have been on something when he invented that.
Wade Davis. A mushroom can launch a part of itself to capture a meal. A flower sinks beneath the swamp surface, feeding live beetles as it goes, serving its reproductive wishes. Strange green worm-like creatures have learned to turn sunlight into foods. The biointelligence of our symbiotic planet. Did I say our symbiotic planet? Is the great, complex, diverse, and wondrous web of life that is ever unfolding ours? Producer Neil Harvey asked biologist Lynn Margulis, what is the role of the human on the symbiotic planet?
Well, we provide a wonderful substratum of organic greasiness for underarm bacteria. We have between our toes these bacteria that produce the volatile amines. 50% of the human population produces the gas methane. Now, we're familiar with that gas. It doesn't really smell. Methane itself doesn't smell. And in fact, that's why the gas companies put small amounts of smelly stuff in there, because otherwise you could be, you know, you could be suffocated with the methane and not know it. But no one knows exactly why we produce it, but we do know that we are a wonderful habitat for the methane bacteria. And perhaps the most deflating fact is that 10% dry weight of our bodies, that's a lot, 10% dry weight, mostly the large intestine, but also the skin organisms, are microorganisms. So that we think we're one individual, but that's part of our arrogance, myth-making. You know, we're here for spreading roaches, spreading the Norway rat. We've done a great job at that. Taking the eucalyptus out of Australia, where it was perfectly happy, and putting it all along the California coast. Taking those ice plant, which you see all over around here, which come from South Africa. We are a really good vector. That is, we move things from one place to another, including smallpox and phosphorus. We're good for making more people. We're really good at that. So we are just carrying around a history that's very human. So much of human behavior is only understandable in an evolutionary and a historical context, certainly not in a rational context.
Humans are indeed part of the weave, serving as we must the vast galaxies of underarm bacteria. If, as Lynn Margulis says, our also-human behaviors cannot be understood in a rational context, then perhaps we are nearer than we think to the wildness that is at the heart of it all. There is a dimension to wildness that some call unknowable, others call sacred. Pioneers say that whatever your perspective, science or spirit, self-willed nature needs the same freedom she gives us, a place to tell her creation story. As biologist Lyle Watson wrote, "We did not come into this world, we came out of it, like buds out of branches and butterflies out of cocoons. We're a natural product of this earth, and if we turn out to be intelligent beings, then it can only be because we are fruits of an intelligent earth, which in turn is nourished by an intelligent system of energy. That would be us, the big us. Breathing in, breathing out, photosynthesizing, and all the rest we don't yet know about. The wonders of Gaia, the symbiotic planet." To find out more about the work and writings of Lynn Margulis, Paul Stamets, Wade Davis, and all of the participants in this series, the annual Bioneers Conference, and membership information, call the Collective Heritage Institute toll-free at 1-877-246-6337. That's 1-877-BIONEER. Or visit the Bioneers website at bioneers.org. To read more in-depth tales of other Bioneers, check out the book and resource guide, The Bioneers, A Declaration of Interdependence by Kenny Ausubel, available through the Bioneers or at your local bookstore. To order a cassette tape of this program using your credit card, call 1-800-388-8273. That's 1-800-388-TAPE. And please specify the program number. To receive a complimentary copy of the New Dimensions newsletter, please write to New Dimensions Radio, Post Office Box 569, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. You can find us on the web at newdimensions.org. The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature, is a production of New Dimensions Radio, distribution by the New Dimensions Broadcasting Network. Executive producer, Michael Toms. Producer, Neil Harvey. Managing producer, Justine Willis-Toms. Recording engineer and mastering, Catherine Vibert. Assistant to the executive producer, Beck Kagiyama. Our theme music is taken from the album Journey Between by Baka Beyond and used by permission of Hannibal Records, a Ryko Disc label. Portions of the script for this program were drawn from the work of Kenny Ausubel. The opinions expressed in the Bioneers Radio series are those of the commentators and not necessarily those of the funders, the Collective Heritage Institute, or New Dimensions Radio. My name is Michael Toms. On behalf of everyone at the New Dimensions Broadcasting Network, I'm wishing you well. This is program number 2920.